This is where normal comes to die. Mediocrity meets its final demise, and the status quo is unabashedly dismantled. Welcome to Reinvention Radio. Now, here's your host, Steve Ulsher.
Hey guys, welcome to a very special episode of Reinvention Radio here with the one and only Mr. Simon Sinek. This episode is brought to you by The Mortar Blog. Perhaps you've heard that apartment buildings can be a great investment, and done right, well, absolutely. Investing in multifamily real estate can provide a nest egg for retirement, and it could even set you free from the 9-to-5 corporate grind, but getting started is hard. Wouldn't you like to learn how it's done right from the pros? Of course you would. So check out The Mortar, where professional investor Jonathan Twombly will share his insider tips and strategies, and it's all free. So just subscribe to The Mortar. That's themortarblog.com. The Mortar. It's what holds the bricks together. And now on to our special episode here of Reinvention Radio with Mr. Start With Why, with Mr. I Have the Third Most Popular TED Talk of All Time with 25 odd plus million views. Again, the man himself, Simon Sinek. Let's get to it. Awesome, awesome, awesome having Simon Sinek here today for a very, very special episode of Reinvention Radio. And, you know, as with all good things in technology in that world, in that arena, it gave us a little bit of bugs there, man, but we worked through it. So thanks for your patience on that. Is this the first blab you're actually doing?
It, for me, yes.
All right. Yay. See, we make Simon Sinek history. Awesome, man. So very cool. Thanks for
it all out before.
Yeah, right. I know. You know, it's funny. I was telling Rich before this, I was like, man, you know, I so hope technology cooperates, and you just absolutely never know. But thanks for sticking with us, man. So look, obviously, you know, your book, your philosophies, what you've been doing, man, have been absolute game changers in the world of business, and even from an individual perspective. I mean, talk to me first about how the whole thing came about. Was this just an idea that you had been toying with? Where did the whole concept of the Golden Circle and the whole Start With Why sort of initiative come from?
Like any idea, it was an evolution, and it was also born out of personal need. It wasn't an academic or professional exercise, commercial exercise. I was always curious why some marketing worked and some marketing didn't. I was a marketing guy, and I looked at the order that great marketers marketed, and it was based on this why, how, what thing, and I put it on a shelf, and it sort of was good for PowerPoints. And then I went through this personal crisis where I'd lost my passion for what I was doing. And it was sort of a really dark period for me. I think a lot of entrepreneurs at some point go through it. And the question is, can you get through it? And really all of my energy went into pretending that I was happier, more successful, and more in control than I felt. Mm. And I was also very embarrassed by this feeling because superficially everything was good, right? I owned my own business. I made an okay living. We had amazing clients. And so I didn't want to complain that I didn't want to wake up and do it again the next day. So I kept those feelings to myself. And like I said, all of the energy I had when I was attending, and I was more in control than I felt. It was a confluence of events that I met somebody who started telling me about the way the human brain worked, and I started putting pieces together and realizing there was this pattern. And I realized I knew what I did, and I knew how I did it, but I didn't know why. So that's where it came from. It came out of personal need. It was born out of struggle.
And do you mind talking a little bit about that in terms of, because on the surface, man, for those who don't know your story, I mean, they would think, Jesus, this guy's got it all together. I mean, you know, 24 million views on the TED Talk. I mean, you've got clients coming out the wazoo. You know, you get paid significantly to speak. What was going on at that point in time? Was it a failing business? Was it a failing relationship? I mean, what was kind of putting you in that dark place, if you don't mind sharing?
Yeah, it's okay. My business was I don't know if I would say. I mean, my business was struggling as a result of me struggling. It wasn't market problems, or you know, it's that I didn't know how to run a business, and I would go to these events like so many people do, you know, where they, for entrepreneurs, that they teach you everything and they have all these famous speakers and all of that. I went to these events, and it actually made it worse because everything that the speakers were telling me that I have to do, I wasn't doing. So instead of me learning, all I did was hear all the things that I wasn't doing. It actually made the feeling a lot worse. Mm-hmm. And it really took a friend of mine coming to me and saying, I'm worried about you, that gave me the courage to attack the problem. It's one of the things I've learned now in even writing the second book, is we're not good at doing things by ourselves. We're social animals, and the stuff works a hell of a lot better when you have support from a friend or, you know, and same with businesses. You know, when people come up to me and ask me to invest in businesses or want me to serve on boards or things, I don't like investing in businesses that have one person in charge. Mm. Because you can be a visionary, you can be an operator, but it's really hard to be both.
Yeah.
And best businesses tend to be two. There's a visionary and there's an operator.
Yeah.
You know, an operator can run a decent business, but it'll never be gangbusters. A visionary could have an amazing business if only they knew how to build it.
Yeah. And so the story behind how you actually ended up with the TED Talk is pretty interesting. I mean, basically, they didn't even, it wasn't like they came to you first. It was almost like a friend basically just stepped in and said, you know, hey, this is the guy that you should be talking to. So, I mean, when you think back on that moment, it was kind of like that weird little fork in the road that your friend had, right? I mean, where they were just kind of like, sure, I'll do it, or let Simon go ahead and do this. This is somebody that you really should have on the stage. So can you imagine,
I had already been given the Start With Why talk for about 3 years prior to the TED Talk.
Okay.
And even that whole evolution was an accident. You know, I never set out to be a public speaker or any of that stuff. Or I've always been a behind the scenes guy. It's kind of weird for me to be in the front. And people just kept inviting me to talk about this thing, and I just kept saying yes. It started with my friends. I would literally start talking in someone's apartment. People just kept inviting me, and I just kept saying yes. And so word got around in the entrepreneur world, and somebody invited me to speak at a TEDx event. I already had a bit of a reputation in the entrepreneur world. So, the fact that I put it on TED.com, I found out the week it happened.
Yeah, that's amazing. And so think about just kind of what that time period was like for you. You went on, you did the TED Talk. I mean, you couldn't have had even inkling that things were going to go the way that they went. What year did that come out? 2010, 12,
9.
Yeah, I knew it was early.
I did the talk in 2009. They put it on TED.com in May of 2010.
In 2010. And from a viral perspective, I mean, did you have anything to do with that? No, it's just, yeah. So why do you think it went so viral, man? Because obviously there's a lot of really good TED Talks out there, but why are you still in the top three in your mind?
I think it's because it's real. You know, it wasn't me wanting something from anybody, and it wasn't me trying to prove anything to anybody. You know, I was telling the story based on my own experience, and I knew it resonated with people because it resonated with me and it resonated with my friends. My friend Charlie Kim has this test, which is if two people find something interesting, then you have a thing. You know, if you're going around trying to convince everybody and everybody goes, nah, that's not a thing, then it's not a thing.
Yeah.
But it was deeply personal, and it still is, and it really matters to me. So that I think the reason why it resonated, and what's so funny is that TED Talk is so imperfect. You know, the audio quality is terrible. The video quality is terrible. My microphone breaks as I'm speaking. They're changing out my microphone in the middle. And so I always remind people that when they get all stressed out, when they have these things, the PowerPoint's not going to work perfectly. I'm like, look, everything went wrong on my talk, and it still made it to number two. On TED.com, so
yeah.
It's fine. The message matters, you know.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting too because one of my favorite expressions that a partner of mine has, he says that version one is always going to be better than version none. You know, and I think a lot of people get kind of hung up in that whole world of perfectionism. As you look back on sort of the things that you've done, I mean, from a career perspective, has it always been kind of when you just jump into the mix of whatever it is and kind of forget about the need for the safety net that the magic has truly happened for you? I mean, talk a little bit about sort of the connection between when you think about the outcome versus just simply doing it for the sake of doing it.
I mean, look, there's a difference between jumping out of a plane with a parachute and jumping out of a plane, right? So I don't believe that you just jump. I do believe that you have the confidence that when you jump, that something will happen. There's no guarantee, and the risk is still huge. You still have to jump out of a perfectly good airplane. But if you believe in your vision, and other people believe in your vision, and there's and there are people who are willing to make sacrifices with you to see that your vision comes to life, then jump.
Yeah.
But I don't believe in blind risk. I think, you know, that's ridiculous. And the daredevilness, sometimes daredevils do have success, but eventually they die, you know, or they die young, I should say. Daredevils don't live very long. And so it's not that I believe in analysis paralysis at all. There's a point at which you have to ship, as Seth Godin says, you know, you got to put up or shut up. But you have to have a deep belief in what you're doing. Like your gut is telling you, do this, you know, and the fear comes from the rational side. If the fear is in your gut, you shouldn't be doing it. The fear should be rational. The fear should be, well, I could lose all my money. I could lose all my everything. If the fear is rational, but your gut is telling you do it, I say do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting. I don't know if, I know that we've never met. So this is the first time we're meeting. So, I mean, I really do appreciate you taking the time and being here today, you know, obviously on this special episode here, Reinvention Radio. But, you know, one of the things that I'm not even sure if you're familiar with or if you've had a chance to do any research into who I am and what I've done is since around that same time, 2008, 2009, albeit I don't have a TED talk with 24 million views, but that's a whole other conversation. But, you know, it's something that I've been teaching around the whole concept of what is your what. So the book that I put on the New York Times bestseller look is called What Is Your What? Discover the One Amazing Thing You Were Born to Do. And I always get that question of what's the difference between your what and your why. And maybe you can kind of give me some insight in terms of how this resonates for you, but your what to me is really that it's how you're naturally wired to excel. I mean, your DNA is wired to excel in a very specific way. And so the what is your what equation combines your core gift, which in your case is probably communication or teaching or something of that nature, with the vehicle that you use to share that gift, and then lastly, the people that you're most compelled to serve. So it's the gifts, the vehicle, and the people that comprise the what is your what equation. And I believe that it is really, really hard to create anything that is sustainable or that doesn't have an expiration date unless you're super clear on what your what is. And so it's almost as if the what is internal in my way of thinking and the why is external. And that's how I explain it, which is the why is what drives you. It's like, you know, if you want to help starving children in Africa, or if you want to, you know, basically feed, you know, the homeless, or I'm just kind of stuck on this food thing. I guess I'm hungry this morning. But, you know, the point is it's what drives you to do what you do, whereas your what is everything that's internal and kind of gives you that natural set of skills, abilities, what's in your DNA, et cetera. Any take on the what versus why as I explain it in that way?
Semantic,
yeah. So do you think that the why is an internal thing as well?
What's that?
Do you think that the why is an internal thing as well? In other words, I believe that your what chooses you. It's not something that you choose, right? So okay. It's chosen you. It's not that what you have chosen.
Semantics. I mean, it's a semantic debate. It's like I got tired of having the discussion with people, what comes first, vision or mission or positioning or brand, you know? Because it's a semantic debate. And so I asked people who believe vision was primary, and they said, well, it's why we do what we do. And I asked people who believe mission was primary, and they said, well, it's why we get out of bed in the morning. And I asked people who believe brand came first, and they said, well, it's why we exist. I said, okay, well, let's call it the why. We can all agree. Because I just got tired of semantic debates. And
yeah.
So this is another semantic debate. I mean, what I've learned is that the why is based on our upbringing. It's who we are. It's what drives us. It's what inspires us. It's not changeable. You have one, and it's fully formed by the time you're 18 or 19, and it's 100% based on the biology of human decision-making. What we do is measurable and calculable, and you can see it and touch it, and it's tangible. If you want to reverse the definitions for a different model, that's fine. But it sounds like what you're describing is the same thing.
Gotcha. So Ani has a question, and her question is,
there's a couple questions. Can I take a couple questions,
please,
from the audience?
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I was going to read off to you here, unless you can just see the feed and you want to just answer them directly.
Yeah. Here's one. From S Talk Ginger. How do you find someone with the same vision or attitude? I said, you know, you want to attract people who believe what you believe and find people who believe in your cause. Well, the way you find them is you start talking. You know, we're social animals, and if you keep all your ideas to yourself, then how will anyone know what you stand for, what you believe, you know? And so when I started talking about the why, literally was every conversation. When somebody says, so what are you up to? I would tell them about the Golden Circle. And I'd get together with old friends and old clients, and they'd say, what are you up to? And I'd start drawing on napkins. I mean, it was an obsession. It still is. You know, I couldn't not talk about it because I was so amazed by it. And I was just a student of it. I wanted to keep learning, and I wanted to keep talking about it so that I could take more. And the more I talked about it, the more other people said, this is really interesting. And people said, I need you to meet somebody. And the more I talked about it, the more introductions other people made. And so my publisher, the TED Talk, everything came from somebody else saying, I want you to meet somebody. And mm-hmm. so the only thing I committed myself to was being the clearest, brightest lighthouse I could be. I would practice articulating and communicating my message in words so clearly that other people could repeat it without me being there. I made the decision not to trademark everything. You know, what's that going to do? All it means is I'm the only person who can use it and talk about it. I wanted it to be open source. I wanted other people to take it and build upon it. I believed desperately in the spreading of the message. And everything I said and everything I did and every decision I made communicated what I believed. There's no mistaking when you read my books, listen to my talks, visit our website, anything that comes out of us, it's committed to the inspiration of people around us, right? There's no mistaking. And so if you want to attract people, you've got to be a lighthouse. You've got to talk and talk and talk, and it will be cumbersome at the start, and people won't know what you're talking about the first 50 or 100 times. But if you believe in it, you practice and practice and practice and practice. When I first started talking about this stuff, people looked at me like I had three heads, you know?
Yeah.
So that's how you find people who believe what you believe.
Yeah.
You know, you become a lighthouse. And they'll be drawn to you.
Just out of curiosity, when you go back to the sort of the inception of Start With Why, which I know you were doing in talks and you were doing things long before the book came out, did you have a book deal in place? I mean, obviously you have it was published, but I would think that no, it was not. So can you talk a little about sort of the origination story then of the book?
It's the same as the TED Talk. The TED Talk, somebody said, I'd been giving this talk for 3 years, right, in long form. I was out there talking, spreading, in small forums, 10 people, 15 people, 30 people, you know, making $1,000, you know, sometimes nothing. I was just out there communicating, banging the drum, and somebody said, somebody had a friend who was putting on a TEDx event, recommended me, right? Same with the publisher. Somebody met me and introduced me to an editor who introduced me to their publisher. And I ended up having a meeting with Adrian Zackheim, who's the God of Business Publishing, the original publisher from Good to Great, and Seth Godin's publisher and Stan McChrystal's publisher and all that. And we had a 29-minute meeting, and 3 days later he offered me a book deal.
Wow.
But that happened also in late 2008. The book and the TED Talk came out simultaneously. And interestingly, the TED Talk had no impact on the sale of the book.
Yeah. Yeah. And in hindsight, do you think that that was the best deal you could have gotten? I mean, should you have held? I mean, you know, it's hard to have that crystal ball and kind of say it again.
Oh, man, this wasn't for the money.
Yeah.
So I met with two publishers, right? And I fell in love with one of them, with Adrian, right? He makes my ideas better. He pushes me like nobody else pushes me. Mm. And I decided I wanted to work with this guy. And we didn't even offer it to the other publisher, right? Mm. I mean, they got very mad at me because they wanted to have their go. And my reply was, well, what's the point? We're going to start a bidding war, right? I may get to the point where the publisher that I want says, too rich for me, I'm out, you know?
Yeah.
For what? So I can get a little more money front end? If it's a good book, you'll make all the money on the back end.
Yeah.
I wasn't in it for money. I was in it to spread a message, and I wanted to work with somebody who I liked and who seemed to care about me and my ideas and would push me in a way that I needed to be pushed. So hold out for what?
Yeah.
The holdout is selfish, and you risk losing everything. Now, if you want to hold out and make more money, I don't judge you. Do it. Just wasn't my MO. I was more interested in getting a message out.
Yeah. So for the second book, was that with the same publisher, or did you end up going elsewhere?
Same publisher.
Yeah. Yeah, it speaks to a lot to allegiance.
I'll go everywhere with him. I don't, you know, it's not the company. It's the person.
Yeah. Yeah. And that obviously speaks to the power of relationships. And it also speaks to, I mean, we talked about sort of the semantical differences between the why and the what and whatnot. We don't have to beat that horse down. But obviously a big part of how you're naturally wired to excel, some of these issues like integrity, like authenticity, like credibility, et cetera, they either go hand in hand, you know, pretty much throughout your whole career, or you pick and choose and you find that your career and your relationships really then ebb and flow.
Hey, do you want a reputation of a person who squeezes for every dime, or do you want a reputation for honesty and integrity?
Yeah.
You know, you can have either one you want.
Yeah.
That's the one thing we're in total control of, is our own reputations.
Yeah.
Other people control a lot of other things, but our reputations are on us.
Yeah. Yeah.
The money comes if that, you know, if you create demand for something, people are willing to pay for it. But you have to believe in what you're creating demand for. Otherwise, it becomes a very, very difficult and uninspiring game, and you'll run out of energy for that game. That game is a hard game to play.
Yeah.
There are other people who play a lot better than me. I just don't think I have the stomach for that game.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people who are a lot richer than me doing the same thing as me, and I don't take as many pills as they do in the morning.
Yeah. I hear you, man. Hey, let me ask you a question, because Ani has a question about the why specifically. And the question is, does the why stay constant once you find it, or can it modify over time?
Your why is fully formed by the time you're about 17, 18, 19 years old. The youngest person I've done a why discovery with was 16 years old, 17 years old, and it worked perfectly. And it's fully formed by that age, and it never changes. Mm. And the rest of your life are simply opportunities to either live in balance with your why or not. And that's why knowing your why helps you make decisions whether you should or shouldn't do something, or whether you should or shouldn't work with someone. You know, I liken it to, I write about it in the book. I call it the celery test, right? Yep. Which is everyone's giving us good advice of what we should do, right? And, you know, you go to a networking event or a dinner party, and somebody says to you, you know what you need to build your business? You need to buy Oreo cookies. You need to eat Oreo cookies. That'll help you like you have no idea. And somebody else says to you, you know what you need? You need chocolate cake. And you know what somebody else says to you? You need soy milk. And you know what somebody else says to you? They said, you need celery. I made millions of dollars with celery. You got to do it. And so you go to the supermarket and you buy everything. You buy celery and soy milk and Oreo cookies and, you know, chocolate cake, because this is all the good advice you got from very successful people. And the problem is, nobody knows what you believe, and you may or may not get some value out of these things, but you're standing in line in the supermarket with all of these products in your basket, and everybody walking past, nobody knows what you stand for. Right?
Yeah.
But if you know your why, and let's say our why is to always be healthy and protect the health of our bodies, we get the same advice from everybody. The difference is we only buy celery and we only buy soy milk, because those are the only two products that make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we're standing in line at the supermarket saying nothing, and people walk past and see only celery and only soy milk in our baskets, they can look at us and say, hey, you're healthy, I am too. In other words, what we do, to use a different word, you know, the things we say and the things we do that bring to life our cause prove what we believe, so that others know what we believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so the value of why is knowing, it's a filter. It's knowing which advice to follow. Because I've been through this. As a struggling entrepreneur, I remember, you know, people would give me good advice and I would follow it because it worked for them. The problem was it didn't work for me.
Yeah.
And so I felt stupid and I felt incapable, and my self-confidence went into the toilet because all of these successful people told me what to do and I couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But as soon as I used my filter, as soon as I understood why, I would dispense with the stuff that was no good for me, and I would glom onto the stuff that I knew would work for me. I made really huge decisions. So, for example, I'm crap at implementation, right? Because I like big ideas, right? I get bored in the day-to-day, right? And so as a company policy, we do now because I have amazing people around me. But when it was just me, I stopped doing implementation because I sucked at it.
Yeah.
I built this wonderful relationship, help people find their why. And then when I got sucked in to be like a traditional consultant to do the implementation, I destroyed the relationships because I did bad work. Yeah. Instead of feeling stupid about it, I stopped doing it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And people say, trust you. I say, I know. So let me work with one of your partners, and I'll work with them. And gotcha. Now I have an amazing group of people who work with me who we've gotten really good at it, but they know to keep me out of it.
Mm-hmm.
They're smart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's obviously a lot about knowing your role, knowing what you're good at, knowing where that sort of, you know, that that area of flow is, whatever you want to call it.
We'll do all of this stuff by accident. You just called it flow, right? How do you turn on flow? It kind of like, how do you get in the groove? You know, how do you make sure you have an idea? It's like, it's kind of lucky. You know, some days you have it and some days you don't. Some days everything seems to go beautifully, and some days things seem to struggle even though you've worked on the same kind of thing a million times before.
Yeah.
This is what the why does. It clarifies that, so it's not a random experience and you can be in the flow many more times.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you a question, just for those who are unfamiliar with what you meant, and I don't want to gloss over this because I think it's really important, because those who are going, well, geez, you know, how can he just kind of shirk the money and, you know, this, you know, they're thinking like, why would he even do that? You talked about the back end. So for those who are unclear on what that means, that it's not the book that necessarily drives the, you know, the income, the success, whatever you want to call it, it's the back end. For you, what is the back end? What's your definition of it?
Okay, let's be clear. It's not about shirking the money. It's about what order does it go in, right? I'll give you an example. So, for example, I talk about the importance of people all the time, right? Did it freeze? Did it pause? Can you still hear me?
Yeah, no, we're good. We're good.
I talk about the importance of people all the time, right? Every CEO on the planet agrees with me. Nobody has ever told me that I'm wrong, right? Everybody says people are important. The question is, where on the list does it come? I can't tell you how many conferences I've been to where CEOs are standing on the, you know, speaking to their employees, and they say, here are our priorities for the new year. Number one, growth. Number two, shareholder value. Number three, customers. Number four, employees. It's always on the list. Yeah. It's always on the list. But I want to know where on the list. And here's the example I would give you. What if I told you my number one priority was growth, and if I take care of my people, then of course I'll achieve my financial goals? Or what if I told you my number one priority was my people, and if I focus on them, of course I'll achieve my financial goals? Which company you want to work for, the first one or the second one? The second one, right? It's so obvious, it's stupid, exactly, right? And so it's not that money's unimportant, it's that it comes second, right? It's that money is the fuel that drives the organization. It's not, you don't buy a car so you can have gas. You buy gas so you can drive the car. Right?
Mm.
The company, the vision, the where you're going, the destination, all of those things matter more than the gas in the car. But of course you need gas in the car, right?
Yeah.
But the car matters more than the gas.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The car comes first, I should say. The car comes first. First you have to make sure the car is in working order, then you put gas in it. That's what money is. Money is fuel that makes a company move. You can invest in R&D, you can invest in people, you can invest in marketing, you can use promotions, you can do whatever you want to do with your money. You can take more vacations, so you're super relaxed, you have big ideas. It doesn't matter, but it's fuel that makes the company go. Not the other way around.
Yeah. And so let's talk about that for a second, because obviously, I mean, you've had tremendous success. I mean, your book is a constant in the top 1,000 of Amazon, and, you know, obviously ebbs and flows for years now. Your TED Talk crushes. You're an in-demand speaker. What keeps the fire going for you at this point?
I'm driven by my cause, you know, to inspire people to do what inspires them. It hasn't waned at all. And I have a vision. You know, whenever we talk, whenever anybody says, Simon, you've done all of these things and all of this stuff, it's tip of the iceberg. I mean, I think about the vision that I have, and I have so much more work to do. You know, I have this vision of creating a world in which the vast majority of people wake up every single morning, inspired to go to work, feel safe when they're there, and feel fulfilled when they come home at the end of the day. I am way, way far away from success.
Mm-hmm.
And anything that I've achieved up until now are simply stepping stones that will help me get to where I need to go to. And I can't do it alone.
Yeah.
I'm just a preacher. That's all I am.
Yeah.
I'm just a guy who spreads ideas. I need people to follow the gospel and believe in the gospel. I need entrepreneurs and CEOs and to build companies based on this stuff. I need employees to demand that companies give this to them. That's why I do interviews like this.
Yeah.
I want to talk to your audience. I want to talk to your entrepreneurs. I want to inspire them to build a business this way, which not only feels better, but amazingly is actually good for business.
Yeah, for sure. Talk about, I mean, to get to the point that you've gotten to career-wise, have you had to sacrifice anything? Any sort of any casualties along the line here since 2009 when everything really started to just blow up for you? Yeah.
Of course.
Be real, man. What talk, because we all face it.
I made a decision many years ago that I would commit myself to spreading this message, and I knew it would come at sacrifice to my personal life. My social life. And it has. You know, I had a lot of, it's not that I had a lot of dysfunctional relationships, I just didn't have relationships. Who'd want to go on a date with me? You know, I'd go on a date with a fantastic woman and I'd be like, oh my God, I had such a good time. Are you free in 6 weeks or date two? You know, that's not, I'm not dateable.
No, I got you.
I knew what I was getting into. And my last book cost me 2 relationships.
Mm-hmm.
I knew what I was getting into, and the good news is I've worked hard for the past decade. This has been 10 years. Getting this message going, it has its own momentum now that I can now start to allow some of the momentum to go and can now take some of the time and foster a relationship that I knew that I missed out on.
Yeah. And do you certify people then in your process now to kind of keep this momentum going? How are you able to replicate and duplicate? I mean, you can only be one person in one place at one time. So right. How are you looking then to expand that vision through others?
I have an amazing team that figures more of this stuff out than I can. You know, I'm still out there banging the drum. I'm still out there writing books. You know, I'm still the preacher, and my team are the priests who are building the church.
Mm.
And we have a Y Discovery course, we have a certification course, we have a public speaking course now that we just launched. We have a partnership with EY, with Ernst & Young,
mm-hmm.
Where they're now taking a lot of the IP and they're helping develop product for entrepreneurs and big companies alike. Both digital product and physical product, consulting product. Like, we're doing all kinds of things. And for me, it's partnerships. It's my own team and people who believe in us and people who believe in this message who want to put their money where their mouth mm-hmm. is and commit to help us build it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's folks out there who are working formally with us and informally with us.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you guys are just joining us here on Blab Live, now would be the time to ask your questions. So just go ahead and type them in there in the send a message box, or you can do the /Q, capital Q there on the left. You'll see that underneath the questions. And we'll try to get to as many of the questions as possible here. One of the questions that just came up, and maybe you saw it here, and I believe Lori actually had an interview with you a while back because she said something to the extent of it's great to see that you still got that same fire since your interview with her in 2009. Her question was, how large is your core team at this point?
A dozen
people. Wow. So you've built, I mean, that's a hell of a machine, man. I mean, that is an actual machine. Now, did you ever want to get to that point of having a dozen people that really, I mean, are these all folks who look to you for a weekly paycheck, or are these independent contractors that are commissionable only? How far have you taken things?
Only 2 people report to me. And so my team that makes me work and helps me is 3 people. Very small. And then we have sort of a separate division that Kim Harrison runs that is everything I'm not involved in.
Gotcha.
And some of them full-time and some of them are part-time. But there's a dozen people that make it work, and it's she's the genius behind all this. I'm just the dancing monkey.
Mm-hmm. Rick wants to know if the why is similar to Joseph Campbell's "Follow Your Bliss." I mean, I have a feeling it's a semantical sort of answer there, but any thoughts on that?
Yeah. Sure. You know, my ideas are. I don't believe that the idea is new. It's thousands of years old. I think the coup, if there is one, is that I found a language that made those who need to listen listen. You know, it's grounded in biology. And so when you hear things like, you know, follow your bliss, as true as it may be, that's off-putting to a lot of people,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how can you go into the CEO of a Fortune 1000 company and be like, so what you need to do is build your company based on your bliss, you know?
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah.
But words matter. Words matter. You know, and very often you find that we choose words that reach the converted, and we think we're doing well because people who already agree with us tell us we're amazing and it's great, we're so right. The real trick is if you can go into a room and preach your message, and somebody comes up to you afterwards and be like, you know, I think this stuff is usually hokey and stupid, and I was really cynical coming in here, and let me tell you, this is good stuff. Mm-hmm. Those are the people. Those are the people that let you know that mm-hmm. you're onto something. And those people, I'm always grateful for the believers, but when I get one of the skeptics, I know that I'm on the right path.
Yeah. And so at this juncture, I mean, again, I'm sure it evolves to some extent over time and is an organic process, but at this juncture, how would you define your why when somebody asks what yours is?
To inspire people to do what inspires them hasn't changed since I first discovered it. And then I'll share the vision that I just shared with you.
Yeah, yeah.
The world I want to create.
Yeah, simple enough. And one of the things that, you know, Sonnet kind of keeps coming up here, and rightly so, I mean, lots of people have, you know, some various questions here, but seems to be a theme. One of the questions that that I had for you that Gerald has here as well is talk about legacy. When you think about your legacy, what is that legacy that you want to leave behind?
You know, I hope, you know, my vision that I have for the world, I do not believe will be accomplished in my lifetime. And so the question is, how will I know that I'm successful? And the answer is, if I've created enough momentum that other people will choose to carry it beyond me. And so for me, legacy is the standard. You know, if you look at second-term presidents tend to be better than first-term presidents because they're no longer thinking about their re-election, which is selfish. They're now thinking about their legacy, which, strangely enough, is more about what they'll be remembered for. In other words, what they did for others, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Not just what they did for themselves. Advice from old men and old women is always fantastic because they don't give a shit
right.
to think about
that
anymore.
Yeah.
And so it's the best advice. It's the best advice. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So all of that is in the legacy department. The question is, why do we have to wait until we're old or, you know, in the twilight years to start considering how we'll be remembered or what work will survive us. Mm-hmm. If you can get working on that a little younger, you have more years and less panic.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody wants their last number in their bank account printed on their tombstone. You know, he gave, she loved, he cared, you know, she remembered, you know, like we want to be remembered for what we did for others. That's what we want on our tombstone.
Yeah.
So live that life now.
Yep. And we all have things that we've heard over time that just kind of stuck with us and really kind of, I guess, if you will, forged us into the person that we are today. Someone say something to you over the years, man, that you remember that conversation like it was yesterday, that really just kind of keeps you on point to this day?
I mean, I've been given a lot of good advice over the years, and I try and share it because if it worked for me, it might work for others. There's one of my mentors, a guy by the name of Ron Bruder, is an amazing guy. And I got good at asking him for help. And by the way, trust is not built when we offer people help. Trust is built when we ask people for help. Hmm. And Ron gave me some advice over the years that saved me a lot of money and that I would have made bad decisions and bad partnerships. And so I wrote them down. I called them the Bruder Principles, and I put them on my blog. I mean, you can go read them. It's just go to simonsinek.com and type in Bruder Principles, and they'll come up. And we use those obsessively in my company. Like, we will not go into a partnership. We will not make a decision without running through the Bruder Principles ever. And they have made all of our partnerships so much stronger and so much better. They're really simple. Do a background check. Do your due diligence, even if it's just a Google check. If you're going to be working with somebody, like, do a little background check, mm-hmm. right? Did a background check on somebody, and I found out that they've gone through bankruptcy a couple times. Well, may not be a bad thing. I just want to know about it. I want to be able to ask them about it. Like, what happened?
You know? Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally get that, man. What?
Others?
No. What I was saying is, obviously you've done quite a bit, and when people look at where you're at, they're going to go, geez, what else would this guy need to do? I mean, he's done so much. So what is next? I mean, what still got you then really fired up? Anything new on the horizon? Anything that is something we need to look for in 2016?
Well, like I said, I've been out there preaching for the better half of a decade, right?
Yeah.
Preaching. And I think there's knowledge and demand for the message that I have, but now we have to help people who want it to build it, you know. And that's why I love my team, and that's why we're focused now on building product and service and all of those things, so that with those who need it or want it can have it. That's the absolute focus for next year.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. Well, I will ask one last time here if there are any other questions that folks want to drop in, and then otherwise we're going to honor Simon's time here and let him jump. But actually, Yvette does have a question. You mentioned a new book. What can we look forward to? What is it about?
I have a book coming out the end of next year, supposedly. That is, it's a departure for me. It's sort of quotes and aphorisms, but I'm taking a new take on it. I'll let you see. It's designed like a children's book. I'm really excited about it. Mm-hmm. And I realize that I write these books that, you know, they're intellectually sort of heady, and you sort of, they're thinking books, and yet there's lessons from these thinking books that you don't need to go read a chapter about biology. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to share some of those lessons in bite-sized chunks to make them more actionable on a daily basis, because I know that it helped me. And so I tend to share things that worked for me.
Yeah, awesome. Awesome. And then lastly, just as far as technology is concerned, you said this is your first blab, man. So really appreciate you popping that with us here, man, on Reinvention Radio. So that's super cool. Hopefully you'll use, you know, this platform moving forward, man, or at least something similar. How do you feel then about sort of this convergence of technologies where everything is done in real time, and you have the opportunity to connect with people in ways that I mean, because obviously with the TED Talk and all, that's kind of a, you know, that's really that pull, right? I mean, somebody sees it, they pull it in. But this is, you know, really a convergence of multiple technologies here where it's more of a forum on a consistent basis. What do you think about this sort of technology? Is this something that you could envision using? And do you, what's your take? And there was a question, what's your take about overexposure? Do you think social media is causing people to become just, shall we say, overexposed?
I mean, if you're going to use social media, I think you have to have a reason why are you using it. You know, I use the ones that I like. You know, I like Instagram. I use Twitter, but I don't use the ones that I don't like. You know?
Yeah.
So that's one, which is you actually have to enjoy it or have somebody who does enjoy it. Otherwise, everybody knows it's just marketing.
Yeah.
It's not authentic.
Yeah.
You know, social media is great. Technology is great. It has its value. But I'm cautious that we don't give it too much credit. It doesn't replace human beings, and it doesn't replace human interaction. You know, like I've actually gone to live events and I said, well, you know, can we take questions? They said, yes, we have people text their question and then I read them to you. I'm like, wait, I have a live audience in front of me. Why are they texting us questions? Why don't they just raise their hand? I can talk to a human being and see the face of the person who wants to know the question.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm a big proponent. You can't build trust digitally. You can't lead people through email. You know, technology absolutely has its value in spreading messages, and it absolutely has its advantages to help us to connect to people far and wide. And this is amazing that I can connect with, you know, however many people are on here today, you know, quickly and instantaneously. But at the same time, you know, none of us know each other. They can see my face. I can't even see theirs. You know, I don't know anybody here, and I wouldn't be able to form relationships with them unless I actually got to meet them and shake their hands and say thank you and thank you for being a part of this. You know, it's, you know, human interaction is king. It's king, and everything else is just helpful.
Yep. I got you. Question quickly here from Frank. What's the most important lesson you've learned from one of your business failures or mistakes?
I mean, it goes back to what I was just saying. You can't do this stuff alone.
Yeah.
You know, the biggest mistake I made was thinking that I had to have all the answers, or if I didn't, I had to pretend that I did. And the biggest lesson I learned was to ask for help and accept it when it was offered.
Yeah.
And no one can build a business by themselves. You're a fool if you think you can. And if you're doing okay by yourself, and when I say build it, it doesn't mean you have to have a business partner. You have to have somebody who's in the background who believes in you and says, you can do this. Because there are absolutely days where you doubt yourself and you don't think you can, and you don't think you're smart enough, and you don't think you have what it takes. And you need somebody who says, this matters. This matters.
Yeah.
And if you don't have that person, it's excruciating.
Yeah. It's, And on the personal front, a lot of people know you on the, obviously on the business front and your message. When the spotlight's off, man, and you're doing your own thing, what's in the iPod? What sort of things are you enjoying in the personal time there?
I just bought $300 worth of Legos.
There you go. See? And you'll be building the Burj Dubai and do the architectural sets and all that fun stuff, yeah?
I got a Fett Slave 1 sitting on my table right there. It took 2 days. It's freaking awesome.
Nice, man. And
I like building things. I like creating things. I take photographs. I'm a tinkerer. I'm an artist. I like tinkering.
Yeah. And so when you're looking back on this interview, when you're looking back on the hundreds of interviews that, you know, that people have done, you know, with you over the years, what's that one question, man, that somebody asked that you were just like, man, that's just either the oddest or the best question I've ever heard. There's gotta be something that sticks out. You've got a bunch of these.
The military asks me the best questions always. I had a Navy SEAL ask me, where does revenge come from?
That is right? That's an interesting question. Yeah.
I had somebody in the intelligence services say, how do we fight an enemy who's really good at everything I talk about?
Mm.
That's a good question.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The military asks unbelievably good questions because they're always thinking about the service-minded. Businesses tend to ask me the same question, tend to be what they can get out of something. It's not better or worse. They just tend to be more repetitive. But the questions that make me think are my favorite questions. The questions where I'm on stage and I don't know. Those are the best.
Yeah. And just give Patrick an opportunity here. He asked, you know, when people are talking about being viewed as the lighthouse, basically, how do they break out from the noise and become relevant? How does somebody stand apart?
That's not your decision. That's not your choice. That's the people who choose to follow you, right? So the best you can do is show up, and if your message is sincere and honest, then others will find it resonant, and others will tell other people about it. So I get this question sometimes where people say, I want to be a public speaker. So go speak. Go volunteer. Go volunteer your church or your synagogue. Like, go give a talk. Go give a talk in someone's living room. Go do something for free. You know, you're not going to make tons of money and, like, be some, you know, make people walk on hot coals or something. You know, that's not how that's not how it goes. It's a process. And if you have a message to spread, tell your friends. That's how I started. I started a meeting with one person across a table for a lunch. And then it became a small group of 10 or 15 people around someone's apartment that I would just do for free because my friends were like, I want to share this with my friends. And it gains momentum. It's like a snowball. It's like, how do I build a huge, huge snowball? You start with a really little one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a process. You know, how do I fall in love? Try going on one date first.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you got to start, but you got to start small. You can start anywhere you want, but you got to start.
Mm-hmm.
And if the message resonates, other people will say, can you do that again? And that's when you start to, that's when the momentum starts to build.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah.
And I don't consider myself an expert in anything I talk about, by the way. I consider myself a student. So I'm always showing up to improve and to learn. And that way, whenever I do something and I make a mistake or if something screws up or even if something goes well, I always want to know what happened so that next time I can improve upon it, because I don't think I'm all that. I think I'm a neophyte. I treat myself as a student in everything I do. I may be more an advanced student than some other people, you know, in some subjects, but I'm always showing up to learn and to give and to share and to improve in everything, even when I'm speaking, you know. I always want to know what I could do better, what could I repeat, what worked, you know, what sucked less. So if you show up as a student and you start small, it grows quite effectively, quite quickly.
Yeah, and out of respect for your time, because there are a few more questions coming in, how long do we have you here, just so I can give a heads up to the audience if they still have any questions?
I'm 20 minutes late for my next interview.
Awesome. Good. So then we've got you for another hour.
Exactly.
No, it's all good, man.
Out of respect to the other guy, I should probably...
Yeah, no, all good, man. And by the way, I will say that in all the blabs that I've ever seen and been a part of, either as a host or as a co-host or as an attendee, I have never seen the applause get to 10,000 as quickly as it has for you, man. So obviously you've been putting out... you know, tremendous wisdom, and really do appreciate you spending some time here with us on a very, very special episode of Reinvention Radio with Simon Sinek of Start With Why. Any other last comments? comments. Anything else you want to leave folks with, Simon?
Yeah, I'm so grateful to you and to your audience. Well aware am I that this vision that I have for the world is just that. It's delusion unless other people are willing to help me build it and preach it and share it and make it their own and build a company that people want to come to work every day and feel cared for and feel safe and go home fulfilled. And so I consider us all an army, you know?
Yeah.
And we all play different roles in this army, but I'm immensely grateful to you to helping me spread my idea, immensely grateful to your audience to be open to these ideas, willing to embrace these ideas, and willing to implement these ideas. So I'm a humble servant to you and your audience. Thank you very, very much.
Well, very, very kind of you, man. We certainly appreciate the work that you've done. So, Simon, really, man, really do appreciate you joining us here on Reinvention Radio, and we will talk to you really soon. Take care.
Yeah, baby. So there you have it. Wow, what an episode with the man himself. Again, ooh, Jiminy, Mr. Simon Sinek. Pretty good stuff, if I may say so myself. And again, we'd like to thank our sponsor for this very, 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 very special episode of Reinvention Radio, The Mortar. Have you ever dreamed of escaping the corporate grind and becoming a full-time real estate investor? Well, Jonathan Twombly made the switch from miserable Wall Street lawyer to full-time real estate investment professional. If you'd like to find out how he did it, subscribe to The Mortar. That's themortarblog.com. And there, Jonathan shares all you'll need to know to learn real estate investing from the inside out. And it's all free. Just subscribe to The Mortar. That's themortarblog.com. The Mortar, it's what holds the bricks together. All right, my friends, thank you so much for tuning in. Hope you learned as much as I did from Mr. Simon Sinek. And we will talk to you in the very next episode of Reinvention Radio. I'm Steve Ulscher. And don't forget to grab a free copy of my New York Times bestseller, What Is Your What? Discover the one amazing thing you were born to do at whatisyourwhat.com/free. And don't forget, if you have a comment, some feedback, a suggestion for a guest, or whatever it might be, if you just want to say hi, give us a call on the hotline at 1-844-MRBOLD1. That's 1-844-MR-BOLD1. And we will address that question, comment, or suggestion just as soon as we possibly can. Check us out on iTunes. Check us out on Stitcher. Check us out at reinventionradio.com. And we'll talk to you really soon.
You just got dismantled. Thanks for listening to Reinvention Radio. For more information about the show and your host, Steve Ulscher, visit reinventionradio.com.